This is Turn It On.
Everybody, and welcome to episode 47 of Turn It On. My name is Michael J., and you have found my podcast. We are coming to you, as always, from beautiful Nashville, Tennessee. My longtime friend Bill Crosby is on the program today, but before we get to my talk with him, it's time for the internationally acclaimed portion of our show. That's not true. Yes, boys and girls, it is time for
Stories from the Road!
And this is part two from last week's installment. Go back and check that out if you don't want to be lost, but I'll recap it for you because I'm a nice guy. So, my old band Exploding Boy had played a benefit show in New York City in 1992 at a place called the China Club, and our drummer Jason had won the grand prize raffle of the night of a custom-made Gibson Chet Atkins SST solid body acoustic guitar. And in 1994, he very kindly gifted this guitar to me for my birthday and told me that the only condition he had was that I play the guitar as much as humanly possible. Jason always believed, as I still do, that instruments were made to be played and not kept in glass cases or stored away collecting dust under a bed or in an attic somewhere. On a side note, for this reason, I'm not a very big fan of guitars that are just too pretty or ornate looking. I'm also not a fan of brand new guitars that are relicked to make them look old. They never seem to look right to me, and there's just something about a beat up Fender Strat or Telecaster or Gibson Les Paul that got its battle scars the honest way that in my mind will always beat out something that someone tried to simulate. And my favorite guitars tend to look something like hot rods from the 50s, bright pastel colors with lots of chrome hardware, and definitely no flame maple tops on Strats or flame maple Les Pauls for this guy. If it looks too pretty, I just don't trust it for some reason, and you can read into that whatever you will. Now, back to the Chet Atkins SST guitar. I followed my friend Jason's instructions gladly, and I took the Chet out on the road with Exploding Boy and played over 300 shows a year all over the East Coast from New York to Key West and as far west as Mississippi and Alabama back in the day, and it started to develop a very lived-in appearance until one night. We had relocated to Washington, D.C., and we were playing an acoustic bar gig just a few hours from where we lived at the time, and the Chet was the only acoustic type of guitar I owned at the time, and as a result, it was the only instrument I had with me. On the break after our first set, somehow the guitar got knocked over and it fell face first onto the stage. It immediately broke in the place where all Gibson guitars notoriously break, right at the headstock. I was horrified. The band was horrified. We had two more sets to get through with no possible other options in sight for me guitar-wise, so we all jumped into action. I'm sure you've heard the saying that duct tape fixes everything. Well, I'm here to tell you that it's true. I've seen it with my own eyes on many occasions, this one in particular. We all had the same exact thought at the same exact time. The guitar was never going to be fixed properly right away, so it only needed to function to get us through the rest of our gig. I loosened the strings, our bassist pulled the headstock gently back as tight as he could, and our drummer Jason took a roll of duct tape and began wrapping it around the end of the neck as tightly as he could. I strung it back up and managed to get it to stay in tune one song at a time. It slowly went out of tune during each song as the tension of the strings pulled the headstock forward, and I would tune it up after each song and we'd play the next one. On the second break, we undid the strings again and the duct tape and repeated the whole process of holding the headstock back and wrapping it with the duct tape. True band teamwork in action. And I did the same thing for all the songs in the third set. Play a tune, tune up, play another one, tune up, and so on. And we made it through. Now, this story does have a happy ending. I had the guitar fixed, and I managed to play another few years of shows with Exploding Boy on the road before we eventually disbanded. And then I went on to use it for the first few years that I lived in Gainesville, Florida, for another 300 to 350 acoustic gigs a year. And sadly, you think I would have learned my lesson, it fell off a stand once again at a bar and broke in a spot right next to where it had been repaired the first time. And I was told after that that there just wasn't enough wood there to make a solid repair by several guitar luthiers that I trusted until I moved to Nashville, that is. It had sat in a case for almost 8 to 10 years at this point, and I entrusted it to my friend Tony Nagy at Grun Guitars here and told him that price and time were no objects. I'm not sure what I was thinking at the time, but I trust Tony. So I asked him if he thought it was possible to bring it back to life, and he told me that he'd give it his best shot. It took him almost a year, but after getting a new set of frets, a full repair, and slight paint job, it came back to me better than ever, believe it or not. The electronics have also been replaced at this time, and the Chet is once again coming out on the road with me whenever I'm called upon to cover acoustic parts for the various artists I play for. So it's now a 25-year-old guitar, and it has all the battle scars to show for it. There's a hole worn in the top from where I rest my pinky, and certain spots on the instrument kind of contour to my body exactly. It fits me in a way almost like no other instrument I've ever owned outside of my 1983 Fender Strat does, and it was quite an emotional thing getting it back from Tony and all the fine folks at Grun Guitars. And that, folks, is this week's installment of
Stories from the Road!
I will post some photos of the Chet in the show notes for this episode on our website, tiopod.com, as it was then, at the time of the break, and as it is now, so you can all take a look at it. All right, my good friend Bill Crosby is here today. Bill and I have known each other for well over 20 years at this point, probably closer to 30. As you'll hear in our talk, he let me sleep on his pullout couch for a few months when I first moved to Nashville about 6 years ago, and he's been very kind and very helpful to me in more ways than I can possibly mention here. Bill does children's music, and I'll be playing one of his songs for you at the end of this talk, so stick around for that. I met up with Bill a few weeks ago at his house, and we caught up, and I will tell you, around 30 minutes into our talk, some kind of air conditioning unit at Bill's house kicks in, and it buzzes for a little while. It's not terrible, but I could not get rid of it. So there's nothing wrong with your devices. Don't adjust anything. It's not you. It's me. Have I set this up enough? I think so. This is me and my good friend, Bill Crosby. You know, it's actually appropriate that we're talking today, because I saw my Facebook memories yesterday that this is almost 6 years to the day when I moved here.
Wow.
It's pretty close, because there were pictures from you and I going out on a Saturday night or something
right,
from 6 years ago, which is crazy. So you, for people listening, I don't know whoever the
fuck. We're just
rolling.
Okay, cool.
I won't put anything incriminating on here.
It's okay.
But, yeah, like, you gave me a place to stay when I first moved here. Let me sleep on your couch very kindly, so.
But it's odd that you'd come here, like, a year before.
I came to visit to check it out,
I think. You came to visit, and then it took you, like, a year to figure out you needed to move here. Which I thought was funny. It's like, well, I'm finally moving. I'm like, dude, you were here, like, a year ago.
It took
a long time to make up your mind.
It was the girl thing.
It was the girl.
It was always the girl. There was a girl involved.
It's always the girl.
It's good that I jettisoned that and got out of there.
That was a trip.
But we hadn't been in touch. We go back like 20-something years.
Talk about the Rochester days.
To Bill Crosby and Optional Stop.
Yes. opening for Exploding Boy.
But that was my first introduction to you. I think we did a bunch of shows where we were like...
Well, I think I met you at the studio with Tony Gross.
Oh, Tony Gross's place, yeah.
Because I was doing my rock album there.
Okay.
At the studio at GFI.
Was that the only thing you did with that? Was it just one? Was it just one project?
Yeah.
Okay. So what... When did you move to Nashville?
97.
Okay, because I hadn't seen you since then, I think.
Well, I think we ran into each other in Rochester sometime, because I remember I saw you maybe at Record Archive or something.
Oh, it might have been.
I hadn't seen you with your head shaved. So there was like a gap of like when I saw you, I'd be like, Mike, what's going on?
Oh, I had long, Now we're both baldies.
Now we're both. I'm looking good.
Bald is beautiful.
But I was thinking about when I first heard your guys on the radio. I mean, Rochester, radio in Rochester they didn't play local music on the pop stations.
Right.
And I couldn't remember. It wasn't CMF. It was like the pop radio station. But I remember hearing Charity on the radio, and I was like, somebody finally cracked the code, and you guys were on the radio and sounded great. And it was just like, I was thinking about that when we were going to do this. I said, I wonder if we're going to go way back to Rochester.
Oh, let's go way back.
But I said, I was always like, and I wasn't really, I was just happy for you guys.
Yeah.
And it was great that like they finally realized that it's okay to play local music on the radio.
Yeah.
Because Uncle Rod did his weird show that was on like at midnight on Sunday night or anything. But
yeah, right.
Like, I mean, I heard it. I was driving somewhere. I was driving by Marketplace Mall and I heard this song on radio and I'm like, fine. And I was proud and I was happy for you guys because no one ever played local music on radio. And then you guys finally got on the radio. And I was just happy. It was a great song and you guys were killing it.
I wish I knew back to then, like what, you know, I mean, I guess I could talk to Tony Gross about it, but it was, we were so young. I mean, we were maybe 19 years old. Yeah. It was tough to tell. It's tough to tell now what, you know, whose palms got greased or what.
Yeah, really. You don't really know how it happened, but it happened.
Well, we had a group of, I think it was like five or six attorneys that all put in about $5,000 to finish the record, to make a music video, and to, I think, do some radio promo. And I don't know, I couldn't tell you, but that was an exciting summer, man. That was like, we were every, you know.
Now, did you guys play New York that summer too? Was that?
We always played New York.
The DJ Martell's thing that you guys did?
Maybe.
In New York? I remember you guys were headed down there to play.
Yeah, maybe. Now, were we opening, were we doing shows around that time or was it before then that we were playing?
I think it was
together?
After.
It was after that.
Yeah, because we only opened for you guys once.
It was only once. That I have more memories of more. Yeah. For whatever reason.
I just remember our bass player played through Tony's rig, and it was like, that was the best our bass ever sounded. I'm like, yeah, this is great.
I just, maybe it's because I knew you were going to be a significant person in my life.
Yeah, maybe that. You threw us a bone. That was funny.
What brought you to Nashville initially? Was it music or what was it?
Yeah, it was, I moved to Cleveland from Rochester in 95. I had a friend of mine who was playing in a couple of bands and I went to visit him. He was just getting out of the service. He's a real good bass player.
Yeah.
And he was playing in this original country band. He says, man, bring your guitar. You can sit in with us. So I got in, I sat in with them and it's three chord stuff. It's pretty simple, you know, and they had like a pedal steel player and a lead guitar player and a guy singer and a girl singer. So they had everything ready, but they didn't have a rhythm guitar player.
Yeah.
And playing kind of country music, you know, even though it was like original rock country type stuff.
Yeah.
But they were like, dude, you're our guy. You got to join the band. I'm like, dude, I live in Rochester and I'm like, I can't join your band. Since I was the last one hired at the job I was doing, I was the first one let go. So I said, well, it's really no point in staying in Rochester because I got an opportunity to play in a band in Cleveland.
Right.
Because I stayed at my friend's place, you know, kind of what you did when you moved here.
Yeah.
And I stayed there for a little while and got a job and I was playing in a band. And then we wound up, our rhythm section guys end up backing another group that were called Golden Tate. It was two girls. One girl, her husband worked for Warner Brothers. So we're like, we're in. And they had just done a showcase in Nashville. And then I joined the band. So it was kind of like, I kind of missed that. But we ended up doing one showcase for Mick Jones for Foreigner. We played a whole set at a club just for him and like a couple of guys from his label. He started a recording label or something. And we got done playing and I was just like, hey man, you know, I'm from Rochester. I'm a big fan. You know, Lou Graham's from Rochester.
Yeah, right.
And he was just like, you're a really good rhythm player. And I was just like, whoa, that's really
from
cool.
Mick Jones.
Yeah, yeah. From like a guy who's doing it.
One of the best rhythm guys ever.
But you know, stuff happens. Yeah. The drummer slept with the singer and the band broke up and the girl singer there ended up moving to Nashville about a year ahead of me. And I was painting houses in Cleveland and I just really was playing music, but I was also working during the day. And I was just like, you know, I think I'm just going to, the songwriter thing was starting. I was in a couple of songwriters and around things. I was doing all the songwriter thing. And I'm like, I really want to be a songwriter. And everybody in Cleveland who was doing music was talking about going to Nashville.
Yeah.
So I had my connection with this woman. Her name's Ricky. And I said, well, I'm just going to, you know, it was the middle of winter. I said, you know what? I'm just going to go. So I just moved here. So.
Wow. So just packed up and
got a job in about 2 weeks and then worked for a printing company. And then started, a friend of mine from Rochester needed a bass player for a jazz group in Murfreesboro. So I was, Tuesday nights, I was driving in the car after getting out of work, driving to Murfreesboro to play two sets and getting home at midnight and trying to get up at 8 o'clock from work the next day.
It was really fun.
But the funniest thing about that is you'll get a kick out of this. You have to take 24 to get to Murfreesboro, yep, yep. But one day I got a 40 by mistake. I'm driving, I'm like, where's that Waffle House from Murfreesboro? Because we hit it at Murfreesboro, there's sure. a big Waffle House right
yeah,
there.
Right.
And I'm like, where is that Waffle House? And they're like, you went the wrong way. I pulled over at another Waffle House. They're like, no, you're 20 miles out of the way. But they had just built 840 between 40 and 24.
Oh, wow.
So I got on that, and I was exceeding the speed limit, kids.
Right.
And I made it in time. I got in and threw on my bass and played I was like a 1 minute late, which is pretty amazing considering how far away from the
game. Yeah. So that was all, that was jazz stuff that you were doing?
Yeah, we were just doing standards and stuff.
So yeah. Were you doing, like, outside of the country stuff that you did in Cleveland, was country like big in your kind of your upbringing or anything like that, or was it something that was sort of because I know for me it was really almost a foreign thing coming from where we come from, because there was a lot more Canadian rock and stuff on the radio and all that sort of stuff. Right. I'm sure country was around, but there was maybe one country station. Yeah, I think
you had your fringe acoustic people like James Taylor and Dan Fogelberg.
Right.
So it was kind of like, you know, to me it was just like acoustic music, you know. But yeah. I mean, you know, your Johnny Cash and your Willie Nelson and, you know, the big ones. And then I think when I was in Rochester, I saw Garth Brooks, a friend of mine
drove
to see Garth Brooks at like 85. I'm like, this is great. I mean, I could sing along with his songs. By the time the second chorus came around, I go,
sure,
this is really good writing, because it's like immediately catchy. And
yeah,
you know, he was, you know, going crazy then. He was, you know, already like bigger than the Beatles at that point.
Right.
But it was just cool to go. And it was just kind of like, I never really paid a lot of attention to it.
Right.
Growing up.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I moved down here, I actually worked part time at Ernest Tubb Records.
Okay. Yeah. I knew that.
On Main Street there and on Broadway. And I got a pretty good education about all things country, because they're all like country music, not like the new country. Old country.
Old school country.
So, I mean, I heard the original, there's a Gladys Knight, there's a Gladys Knight song that has an old, there was actually a remake. I thought they had written it, or Motown had written it. It was actually an old country song. And it wasn't Neither One of Us. It's one of those early, you know, Gladys Knight, Pips. Yeah, she sings something, you think she wrote it.
Yeah, right.
Like, it was like, it's actually an old Ray Price country song. And I was like, this is really cool to hear the originals, you know. It's like,
yeah,
it's like Aerosmith's 10-inch record. You know, you hear the original was done by a woman. I said, this must have been scandalous when it hit their airwaves.
Yeah, sure.
When it
sure.
first came out. Right. There's a woman singing about a record, you know.
Right.
And Aerosmith's version is exactly the same. They just put guitars instead of saxes and horns. And it's just, it's very creative. And like, I don't know how they found the song, but it was just funny to hear the original. And you're like, wow, this is really crazy.
Let's go back to the beginning, because I don't know. I mean, we've been friends for a long time, but I don't know much about your upbringing or all that kind of stuff. Like, was there music in your home growing up?
Well, my mom played piano, and she sang alto in the church.
Okay,
which is already kind of an unusual thing. It's usually, you know, everybody wants to be the lead, but my mom was like the harmony singer in church.
Okay.
So there was always music around. My brother played sax. My sister played flute. Okay. I was started on the trombone.
Yeah.
My younger brother played baritone. And then my youngest brother played trumpet.
Okay.
And we all had Roger Eckert for band director, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah.
And he was a really big influence on me music wise, because I played guitar in the jazz band, and I played trombone in the concert band, and I was just starting on guitar. I wasn't great on the guitar, but I could play the chords and stuff. But he always used to yell at me. I actually ran into him last year sometime and got to tell him that what a big influence he was. But he used to, well, I was always noodling on the guitar in jazz band. You know, if he was working with the sax section or something, trying, okay, work on this part.
Yeah.
And I was over there noodling around on the guitar, and he would just yell at me. He'd be like, Crosby, practice at home. And he must have said that 100 times in the 2 years I was playing jazz. But he was a guy that made records, and he taught school.
Sure.
And he taught private lessons.
Yeah.
And he was just a professional musician.
Yeah.
And he approached teaching us that way. It's like, hey, you need to learn how to read chord changes. You need to know how to swing. You need to know how to, you know, play with an ensemble and everything. And we really got, you know, when I went to school in Ohio for music, my theory teacher was writing down he was doing an example of something, and he wrote down the C major scale. People were writing it down and their notes. Like, if you don't know, why are you in college for music if you don't even know what a C major scale is? You know, right. And I realized I probably got a year and a half of theory in high school. So wow, I was already, okay. By the time I got to college, I go, like, these people are really like, you know, hey, I want to be, it's like, you need some background here, people. And I'd gotten that in high school. So it was great. But yeah, my music, my folks were, you know, listening to jazz stuff and, you know, we sing Christmas carols around around Christmas time with the whole family around the piano.
Okay.
And everything.
Yeah.
So we were all, you know, nobody was like a prodigy or anything, but we all played, you know, brother played in the jazz band. My sister played in a classical, concert band and everything. And I started on trombone and I just started playing guitar and,
So trombone was the first instrument. Yes, okay. And then you moved your way to guitar.
Yeah. Yeah,
what kind of stuff was going on then? Like who were the bands or the people that kind of got you into like, I want to play guitar. I want to do that. You know, do this.
Chicago, man.
Chicago. Yeah.
Chicago
okay.
was, all right. When I bought their first album, which came out in 74, you know, they had pictures of everybody playing on the inside and I would listen to the record and I go, okay, that's the bass there. And I learned a lot about production and recording and everything just from figuring out who was doing what.
Yeah.
Cause there's so many people in the band. I'm like, okay, that's piano there and that's organ there and that's guitar. And so, but that was, I always been a huge Chicago fan and you know, they had so many great songs and you know, having the horns with the band. That's my kid's band right now. We have horns.
Well, I knew you were maybe that's where the trombone kind of put that in your head.
That's what I hear. But, you know, Tower Power. And back then, you know, Aerosmith, Rush. I saw Rush's first show in America.
You know, did you really?
It was Angel, Rush, and Blue Oyster Cult. It was at the Dome Arena.
The Dome Arena.
Yeah.
Wow.
And Blue Oyster Cult was amazing. But the funniest thing about that, you know how the Dome Arena is set up? There was this big pile of garbage and vomit and beer bottles and booze bottles. And like we couldn't really see, so we wound up getting behind. This circle was probably 30 feet by 30 feet. Everybody just deposited everything in this pile of junk. And so we ended up standing behind it just so we get a clear view of the band, me and the buddies that went with.
Right.
I went with. It was just so funny because people would walk in there, you know, it's like, oh, there's a spot. Oh, they would slip and fall. And it was just disgusting. But that was, you know. Like I said, we went to Peter Frampton. We went to all the shows. Somebody was asking me the other day what my first rock band was. And we were on vacation in Walt Disney World in Florida.
Yeah.
This is how much of a music geek I was. they had the orange amps.
Yeah.
The rotating Leslie speakers.
Yeah.
And the group was called Bo Donaldson and the Haywoods. They had the song Billy Don't Be a Hero.
Okay.
From back in the 70s. But they opened with Smoke on the Water by Deep Purple.
Right.
And I was like, I was probably 14 or something. I was going like, hey, they didn't write this song. What are they doing?
Right.
So I was already a music nerd in my early teens. Because I was like, hey, they didn't write this song. How come they're playing this song? That's Smoke on the Water. So, just one of those funny things you remember.
Yeah, right. Did you have bands like growing up? Were you playing bands? Or?
Yeah, we played. I had my brother Tom played bass. My friend Ron played drums, and we had this guy named Charlie that sang. And we did all like Aerosmith, and we did one Angel song, and we did all these like terrible cover versions of songs. We were not that good, but it was really fun. And then from that band, the guys I knew in high school, Don Torpy and the Eggleston brothers played horns. So we started a Chicago band.
Oh, okay.
I was probably in junior high, but I remember sitting in classes and like transposing horn parts for whatever songs we're doing. So I was in school, but I was really working on the music. So it's always like, you know, music is never far from my thoughts. You know?
Sure.
So
were you playing out at all around town?
I don't remember us doing too many gigs, but I was just a singer because I had the guitar, I think. So
yeah,
I didn't really have a lot of confidence in my singing back then. And so that was kind of like, you know, I'm sure the vocals were a little lacking. trying to sing Chicago with the, you know,
that's not easy.
Squeak and stuff. So yeah, it was fun. But even my first band, we did some original music. And the Chicago band, I think Brian wrote a couple of things. The trombone player, he wrote a couple of songs. We did. So I was always very much into. You know, I knew the covers, but I really ended like doing our own thing. And I think that kind of that independent of the like, you know, your own thing is always cooler than, you know, trying to do cover songs and everything. So
yeah.
That's when I moved to Nashville. I was just like, I didn't want to play other people's songs. I mean,
right.
I did it. I played in those bands in Cleveland. We did all sorts of country songs, Shania Twain, and we played all these songs, and it was great. It was good education
on
how to play and do country music. But I said it was just a way to make a little extra money. I mean, I really wanted to do my own songs.
So.
But I remember going to the Bluebird, you know, everybody comes to the Bluebird, they got to do the songwriter thing.
Right.
I remember getting there super early, and I practiced my song because you only get 2 minutes. So I worked on a verse and a chorus of this one ballad that I'd written, and got in line, got up there. I was super nervous.
Oh, so you actually played the Bluebird?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
I auditioned for the Bluebird.
Oh, you auditioned for the Bluebird.
It's different. Okay. Sunday morning, noon, in line, everybody comes in, and you only get 2 minutes. And this is so crazy that I remember this, but the first guy got up there to sing, and he had like the Riders of the Purple Sage, or the, you know, the chaps on and the cowboy hat.
Yeah.
And he did the song about John Denver, and we're all like, okay, he's gone over 2 minutes. They shut the PA off. That's how you know he went over time. And I'm like, wow, that was brutal.
Yeah.
So I got up there, and it was just like, and I was like the fifth or sixth person in line. And I got it up there, and I think I did okay. But it was so fascinating to me because one guy sang, just had a beautiful voice.
Mm-hmm.
And the song was like lame, you know? So I was just like, and there were people who could barely sing that it actually did good songs. So I said, you know, this is what made Nashville great. The singers can't write and the writers can't sing. So this is all the melding pot of here. But I ended up talking to this guy that was such a great singer. And he goes, yeah, I studied opera. You know, I came down here to try.
Wow.
And I'm like, dude, you can tell. Cause he hit some high notes. And it was like, the tone of his voice was like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, if you get accepted, you get a letter in the mail in a couple of weeks, and if you hear a couple of days, you know, you didn't make it on your audition. So I got something in the mail like 4 or 5 days later, and I was like, oh man, I got something from the Bluebird. I'm all excited about it. And they're like, you didn't make it. And I'm like, and then they give you the explanation. Well, it could be that, you know, somebody did a ballad right before you. We didn't feel like listening to another ballad. And I go, well, that's what happened to me.
Yeah.
I didn't know they were judging this on what they're listening to. I thought they were judging on what you're writing and how you're performing.
Sure.
So it was just this odd thing. Like, well, it sucks for you because the guy ahead of you did a ballad and we got tired of ballads.
Right.
I go, that's why I didn't pass.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
How about listening to my song and my lyrics and my couplets and the melody in it? So it was just a trip.
Man, that always used to kill me back in the day too, when we would submit things to record labels. And I think I had a sense of that back then, that like, you just never know. It's all based on the particular mood of the particular person that you're getting at that particular time listening to your stuff or whatever.
Well, we did that when I got to kind of be on the other side of that, because when I lived in this, in Cleveland, there was a band. We were, you know, having a friend of ours in Warner Brothers. The guy would just bring over a basket of demo cassettes, and we would throw them in there, like, nope, 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 nope. Oh, that's kind of cool. Nope, nope. And we listened to, you know, we'd sit there and listen to the 50 cassettes.
Yeah.
There might be one or two songs that we thought we'd cover.
Yeah.
And I'm like, so that's one bag. So you can imagine a record label getting thousands of them per day of demos of people that want to get signed. It's got to be crazy.
You got to wonder at what point they just stopped listening to stuff. And you know, and I think that's a lot of the way things would work back then, was they would hear about some band somewhere doing something, and somebody would say, well, you got to go see these guys or see those guys. And because I'm sure the cassettes got ridiculous after a while.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's probably stuff that they listen to and go, okay, this is a possibility. You know, I mean, there's a million things in the music business that could go wrong. They could send a guy out to hear your band on a night you have laryngitis and you're not singing well. It's just like, well, okay, well, we're not going to sign them. You know, it could be that arbitrary. So it's kind of like, you know, and I think now it's different. I think the more people are doing their own thing, which I think is great. You know, I mean, everybody has Pro Tools in their house.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm glad and all the recording studios on Music Row are now salons, which I think is hilarious. This is like, well, I'm not gonna be bitter today.
Don't be bitter. There's no reason.
It's great. There's room for everybody.
You must have seen. Like, I mean, what was Nashville like back in '97? Like, it must. And you must have seen.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm like nowhere near what it is now. In fact, we played here twice back in around that time period.
Yeah.
It's 97, 98 ish. And I have such a foggy memory of it. I remember coming and playing down. We played at some place off of 3rd. I think it was like Music City Mix Factory or something like that.
Yep, that was around when I got there.
And we also played Exit In, which is still there. We played so many places back then. I remember coming in and seeing Nashville and being like, cool, we're in Nashville. And we went to Groon's Guitars, which was down on Main, or on Broadway at that point. Yep. And the Exit In show, I think we just went straight to Exit In, played the gig, and then drove out that night somewhere.
Go play Memphis.
So. Well, we stopped in Memphis. I think we played Memphis, but I think we stopped in Memphis to see Graceland at like 5 in the morning or 4 in the morning just because we were like, oh, we got to go see it. So we stood outside, saw the wall, took a few photos, and then left. Yeah. But what was going on back then? Was it a lot of like...
After driving, of course, you drive through Cincinnati from New York.
Sure.
Cincinnati was like this metropolis on the water and the hills. And I mean, I was just like, oh my God. It was like something out of a movie. I'm like, I cannot wait to get to Nashville. I mean, look at Cincinnati.
Right.
You just drove through, the lights were on. So it's a beautiful city on the water. And I got to Nashville. And the only thing on the skyline was the Batman building. So it was just a trip. I'm going like, this is Nashville? And I'm like, what? I think we just passed in Cincinnati. Cincinnati looked more like Nashville than I thought it would.
Right.
Of course, we've caught up now with everything.
Yeah, right.
Now I look at the skyline. I'm like, yeah, now we're getting somewhere.
It's kind of funny. I had that experience with Memphis, especially because, you know, you hear all these things about Beale Street, and then you get there, and Beale Street's like a block.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's like, there's nothing. And the Bluebird, similarly, like, man, I didn't really even know where the Bluebird was until a couple of years ago. I mean, I've lived here for 6 years now, and I'd driven past it a thousand times.
Oh, yeah.
And somebody, I was in the car with somebody, and they pointed it out. They're like, oh, yeah, there's a line at the Bluebird tonight. And I'm like, that's the Bluebird?
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't look like it. I mean, it's such a legendary place, and it's like nothing like what you expect it would be. Well,
the places that I really enjoyed, there's a place called Ace of Clubs.
Okay.
Which is super cool. And I think it's right where there's a Crab Shack there. Might have been a Crab Shack back then, too. And, but that place, I saw Amy Grant perform with Gordon Kennedy and, they wrote If I Could Change the World for Eric Clapton.
Oh, wow.
So Gordon Simmons and somebody Kennedy.
Okay.
And Michael McDonald sat in with the band. And, Steve Bruton played, who I became a huge fan of, a really funny guy from Texas.
Yeah.
He ended up producing Chris Christopherson and a legendary performer who died of cancer about 4 or 5 years ago. But he was on there, and Jonelle Mosser sat in with Delbert McClinton.
Wow.
And then my parents were up visiting, and I took them to see the show, and they were like, my parents were like, I can see why you live here.
Because
it was just a fantastic night of music. I mean, to hear Amy Grant with her acoustic guitar, I mean, it was unbelievable.
We had that kind of experience when I first moved here too, where like it's Music City and you think about that, but then you start getting out and about and seeing what's going on. And I had some friends in from Florida, and I think we went to 3rd and Lindsley, which is one of the first places you kind of turned me on to when I first moved here. Yeah. And it was I don't know what night of the week did the Time Jumpers play, like Tuesday?
Monday nights.
Yeah. It was Monday night, and like Monday night of all nights.
Right.
So we went out, and I was like, well, let's go to 3rd and Lindsley, because this is a place my buddy Bill told me about. This was like right when I first moved here. Yeah. And we went in there, and I think we paid $5 to get in or something like that. Yeah. And it was the Time Jumpers. And why am I forgetting his name? The guitar player's with Chicago now.
Vince Gill.
With the Eagles. Chicago. Yeah. So Vince Gill was one of the nights where Vince Gill was playing with him. And man, it was one of the most magical nights of music that I'd ever seen. And I think we paid $5 to get in.
Yeah.
On a Monday.
Well, it's a lot more expensive now, but
probably, yeah.
Yeah, that was, I always tell people is that that's one of the best ensembles. Well, now I would say the Punch Brothers now, but as far as playing that kind of music, the Western swing, and just when I first time I saw them and I saw they had three violin players, I'm like, oh no, this is going to be bad. But they all were fantastic. Cause yeah. You know, it's like a horn section, you know, they're phenomenal. So I got to see Dawn Sears, you know, last time I went. Of course, she's gone now. She died of cancer, but Vince Gill is right next to the Franklin dude on the pedal steel, and they're having their own show.
Right,
you know, the rest of the band's playing the songs, but those guys back and forth just playing off each other. I mean, it's just such a great night of music. I mean, it is.
I can see why a lot of people are drawn to Nashville, and I can also see why a lot of people stay for a year and then leave. Only the strong survive here, kind of.
Well, it's all different circumstances. If you come here and say, "Oh, I'm going to make it." Well, you know, get in line.
Most people do, I think.
There's a million people ahead of you that are trying to do the same thing. So you have to be here because you love music.
Yeah, right, I mean, right.
It's not about fame. If you want fame, there's other ways to do it. But, you know, we're here because we love music. And
well, it's a
creative community.
Right, you know? Exactly.
They say Nashville's a good place to fail. Because there's so many creative people here.
No, right.
You know, these are everybody here is talented in their own way, and they're all creative, and they're all trying to do things. And you know, it's not easy, but it's also simple. If you love music and you want to do it, where else are you going to go? Where you can actually have a life and still kind of pursue your dream at the same time.
Exactly. So, how long did you do, I want to know how you got into doing the children's thing. Like, was that something that was, like, how long did you do this, the regular songwriter thing before you kind of, the light bulb went off and you went, maybe I should try my hand at this?
Well, there was the drug years. No, I'm just kidding. I did an album here. I worked with a guy named Sean Pody and some of the guys from Trace Atkins' band were friends of mine. We all kind of, like, became, my friend Emmett from Rochester came down and played on the session, and I had probably 10 songs that I just wanted to record.
Okay.
And even when I was in Cleveland with the band with the two girls, I wrote a couple of country songs for them, and I wound up putting like this album together, and it wasn't on a label. I paid for it myself. I was working two jobs at the time, and we got all the recording done, and took it to a guy named Mike Bush, who you met, and great guy, rest in peace.
Yeah.
And we put together this demo song of like 10 of my songs. And of course, I sent it back to my family to say, hey, you know, it's like, I made an album, check it out. And my nieces and nephews were, you know, they were impressed with my, that I made a record. Uncle Bill made a record. So, of course, but their parents were like, they're walking around singing these whiskey and honky tonkin' songs, whiskey drinking songs. Said, and my sister, who's a teacher, my mom was a teacher, and my sister said, she goes, why don't you write something more for your nieces and nephews, like for kids? So I was like, well, I'd never really thought about it.
Yeah.
So I wound up writing, I'd seen Drew Carey in Cleveland at a New Year's Eve comedy show, and he did the snail joke about the guy. He said, here's a knock on the door. He opens up the door, there's a snail there, and he picks up the snail, he throws it in the yard. Like a year later, he hears a knock on the door, and he opens the door, the snail's sitting there. It's like, hey, what was that for? So, and he did another snail joke, which I don't remember, but I ended up writing a song called I Have a Pet Snail, just because of Drew Carey.
Yeah.
And I had a couple other songs, and I had a friend of mine that had kind of contracted me to write a song for her kids' chorus, because she heard about me doing this, writing some kids' music. So I was up there, and I was able to play for her classroom doing some of these kids songs that I'd written, and the kids were like, they were loving it.
Okay,
so maybe I need to do this. And I wrote a song at work one night. I was working nights at UPS, and I wrote Mosquito from Toledo, and I was laughing at the same time that I was writing it. I go, I really need to pursue this, because it's my sense of humor, and I have to write catchy stuff, which is, you know, because kids, I want the kids to be able to sing along with.
Sure.
Same thing I did with, you know, when I went to hear Garth Brooks. So like, wow, by the time you get to the second chorus, you know, it's laid out for you. You know what to do. You sing along. So,
right.
So I put this album together, and a friend of mine, Mike Bush, mastered it, and which is really cool. And it started a long time, probably 10 years of working with him, which was awesome. But a friend of mine's wife listened to the Sirius there was a kids station on Sirius Records, uh-huh. on Sirius Radio, which was new at the time. I'm like, oh, that's cool that they're playing kids music. And he said, you should send him your album. I'm like, okay. So, yeah. You know, a month later, I'm talking to him. He goes, yeah, my wife told me she keeps hearing your songs on the radio. And I'm like, this is amazing.
Yeah,
like, I never thought, you always hope that your song would get on the radio. But here I am, like, they're playing my songs on radio.
Right.
So that kind of got me doing some gigs around town and playing. And I just, like I said, it's just so much fun just to have kids enjoy what you're doing. And, if I'm having fun, then I know they're going to have fun.
Sure.
So and I can't write stupid songs because I have to perform them. It's not like I'm writing for a clown on a TV show. It's like, I'm kind of like the guy. So if I like the songs, they're going to be more, because I don't want to be, there's, like Charlie Waffles, which was on Two and a Half Men.
Yeah.
He did those songs about, I like boobies and all this. It's kind of like, and he was drunk when he was doing those songs. So I like to be sober. So I really just apply my songwriting passion, I guess.
Right.
And my sense of humor and my, I grew up in a great family and my parents are still together and my family very supportive and they're all great people. And,
sure.
We're all college educated and, so it's kind of like, it became more of me to do that than actually write all these other, She Broke My Heart, I Don't Ever Want to See Her Again songs, which everybody does. So I kind of like steered off the path of, coming to Nashville to write a hit song. I'm kind of like doing my own thing.
Which
is fun.
Well, and you're incredibly prolific too. Like it seems like you've always got something else coming out or something else.
It's like I love what John Lennon said. He says, I don't write them. I just write them down. And I always feel like that's so profound because you don't really know where songs come from.
Yeah.
You can kind of back up to say, I listened to this kind of music when I was a kid. And, there's a certain, it's almost like, they say it's like you're tuning a radio station, then you find your station. Like, this is, and I'm sure you do that with your music, which is great, by the way.
Yeah.
A little plug for you.
Oh, thanks.
So, but I have a problem with your new EP because I think your last album is better than the new one. So
oh, probably is.
That's just my opinion.
No, that's fine. I would agree with that.
I listened to my iPod the other day. I was like, that's a really great album.
Oh, thanks.
So, I don't know who Maria is, though. No, long story. Okay. So for me, it's kind of like, and I look at it like a gift. When you write a song, it's kind of like, where did this come from?
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, you can backtrack and say, I play guitar, I know the chords, I know the groove, but there's a certain spark of inspiration or creativity that it's just, you can't figure it out. You can't sit down and go, I'm going to write a song, but I might have an idea. I got a song that we just did a video for, a little shameless plug. We just did a video for my song. It's called Bears Love Cupcakes. Because I remember seeing a story on Facebook or Instagram or something about a guy who was cooking cupcakes for his son's birthday party, and he had to go leave the room, and he came back in, and there was a bear in his kitchen. And I go, that would be a cool idea for a song. But it wasn't like I just wrote it. It was sitting in my computer for about 2 years.
Right.
And I finally just got like, I forgot about doing this song. And just like, it all fell together. And it's magic when it really happens.
Right.
I might have an idea for a song. It's actually a funny thing. And I shouldn't even say this because I'm going to have to write the song. But I saw the sign for, who's got the new Honky Tonk? Somebody has a new bar in Nashville now. It's not Blake Shelton. It's Kid Rock.
Oh, Kid Rock, yeah.
It says it's big, and there's a picture of a donkey. It says Honky Tonk.
Yeah.
So I go, I said I could write the Honky Tonk and Donkey. It would be a funny kid song. But I'm like, that's stupid. I'm not going to write that song. But it's in my brain now, so I know eventually it's going to pop out as a song. So
yeah, right.
That's just my process of like, I would never write that song. And I'm like, okay, now I'm going to write this song. So they kind of fester. They're like, there's like a beehive of ideas floating around. And somebody may say something to me and like, you should write a song about that. I'll be like, no, I'm not going to write a song about that. And a month later, I'll be like, okay, here it comes. It's like the gestation process that happens for songwriters is kind of like, I know people who have written, who work on the same song for years and years and years, just kind of honing it and getting it right and everything. And it's, everybody has their own process, which is pretty cool thing.
Yeah. And I played a couple gigs with you, and it was always a blast. Back at the old
Family Wash.
Oh, the Family Wash.
I look at a little code that you had for my songs. I look over on your iPod, you're like D G. I'm like, this is it, the whole song.
Well, they were fun. It's fun to watch little kids, you know, kind of get into the whole thing because they've never seen anything like it before. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So their little brains are exploding with it, you know. So that's got to be a complete complete.
It's really so much fun. Like I said, you know, I had one of the songs on my new album was called "Loose Tooth," and my because a kid came up to me at a gig, he said, you know, he couldn't wait to show me. He's like, "Hey, look, I got a loose tooth," and he's moving his tooth around, and I'm like, "Oh my god, it was so funny." He's like, "I don't know this kid,"
you
know,
sure.
I'm like, I'm, yeah, you know, right. I just like, I'm a friendly guy, so you know, like I can get away with it. But I'm like, I would just sit there, I'm like, "Where are your parents?" You're
right.
just go up to this strange tall man and say, "Hey, want to see my loose tooth?"
Hey, check it
and
out.
It was just so funny, and I was just like, "That's, you know," but kids come up and all the time and say crazy things. I did a kind of a question and answer thing at one of my gigs up in Ohio, and the kid raises his hand. He says, "I said, well, what's your question?" He says, "My dad's bald too." And I'm like,
"Not so much of a question, more of a
not really a question." But I just, you know, like, it's funny. The kids, you know, and one of the shows we did a family watch. The guy, I announced that we were going to do. I think the young boy was there with his grandmother.
Yeah.
And she was just sitting there, and I said, "Well, this next song we're going to do is called 'There's a Skunk in the Trunk,'" and just the kid's jaw just dropped, and he looked at his grandmother like, "Oh my god, this is the coolest thing ever!" So, it's just funny. The kids' reactions are always great.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I said, I mean, you know, it's like everybody's says the same thing. Like, the show is out in the audience. Like, you know, musicians do the same thing every time.
Right, right.
But it's like we're entertained by what's going on in the crowd as much as they are with us. Hopefully, but.
Like, I always said that like children are like little drunk adults.
That's funny.
Falling all over.
Oh yeah, you know? the dance lines going around. The kids chasing each other around the place.
It's been
really a lot of fun. But I think, you know, like I said, my priority is always the songwriting. Like, I want to make sure the songs are in good form and make sense and, you know, tell the story a little bit. So I'm songwriter first, and then you know, all the rest of the stuff comes out.
How many records do you have out now? Is it a couple?
This is my seventh.
Oh, seventh.
I'm working on.
So. Like a couple, right?
Seven. Too many. So, but it's funny how, like, even on my live set, we got the Ween stuff down, stuff that we play that I know works. And I probably have another, you know, two other sets that I could do, but
sure.
There's some songs, you know, and you know this from playing.
No, right.
Some songs work
right
at a crowd.
Yeah.
And, you know, I like it when, you know, there'll be somebody in the audience. You know, we played at the Family Wash one night, and this woman there, a girl with dreadlocks, and I was like, okay. Then she was like, oh boy. After the first couple songs, she's like, oh my god, this is going to be stupid. It's a kid's show. And like, by about the fourth song, we did my song Big Mouth, which is like a reggae song about a hippopotamus. And she started bobbing her head a little bit. And I could tell she was having a good time. But like, for the first couple songs, she was rolling her eyes like, oh god, I don't want to hear this. And it was just, and so for me, about being a, you know, performer, and I'm like, I love that, because it's like, hey, I won her over, you know?
Right.
So,
yeah.
So, but it's good. So,
winning over hipsters to the.
that's gonna be my live album. Yeah. Winning over the hipsters.
It's really, honestly, as we're talking to you here, it's wigging me out that I'm sitting on the very couch that was a pull-out bed for me.
Why is that? Why is that wigging you out?
Well, it's wigging me out because, well, I don't know. Did you ever have that experience where
it's not deja vu if you've actually done it?
We're friends. If we, you know, we can talk like this. But it's I never would have dreamed 6 years ago that I'd be sitting in your living room doing a podcast that I have like 40 something episodes of, at this. So it's kind of weird. You ever have those kind of experiences where you're on stage? Like, did you ever think you'd be doing kids music? Like,
no,
back in the optional stop days?
I love playing music. Like I said, even if I was in a cover band, I'd be happy, you know, but it's just not it wasn't my calling or my mission. And, you know, like I said, I think it's important to do something positive in the world.
Right.
Rather than, you know, I don't want to be beating people over the head. I'm not a very political person. I try to be a good person, and I'm not.
Sure.
I think it's important to do something positive, especially for a young audience, because there's so much stuff that they're exposed to that's bad. I it's kind of like my mission to, you know, have some joy and some positivity to to the world.
Well, I think it's great because, I mean, for me, some of the most important people in my life were teachers growing up. And, right. I think what you're doing right. is very similar yeah. to that in scope, where it's, you know, it's influencing these kids or maybe giving them an exposure to music that they didn't have before yeah. and maybe oh, yeah. inspiring them to someday be, you know, be artists themselves
right.
or something like that, you know?
You know, I mean, I growing up, I mean, having Roger Eckers, our director of music, I mean, we saw a jazz guitarist. We had all these guest artists, you know, Herb Ellis, great jazz guitar player,
sure.
did a thing for high school kids.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, how does this happen? You know, it's like right. a guy who was a phenomenal artist came to a high school to do a concert and, you know, I managed to play with my college band with Ed Shaughnessy, the drummer from The Tonight Show.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And you know, so there's been guest artist things that had a big influence on me.
Right.
Because, you know, if you go to school every day, you're looking at slides or the teacher, you know, but having a musician come in,
yeah.
it was always a big deal.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, right.
And it was like, so I think for me, it's fun. You know, kids walking down the hall, hey, there's that Pet Snail guy. And, you know, it's just kind of funny because it's, you know, it's nice to be, you know, to do something that you care about. And, you know, and I'm not slogging away playing, you know, classic country songs in the bars one night. Like, I joke with my band all the time, and they're always like, "It's like we're playing at 10 o'clock. That's in the morning, right?" I go, "Yeah, I don't play in the dark. I play in the daytime." So,
right? Yeah, that's got to be nice too. Like doing gigs early because
you have a New Year's Eve gig. What time? You have to be there at 10 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, we have to be there at 10 o'clock in the morning. So, it's really fun. So.
Yeah, so that's
fun. Yeah, we're gonna actually do a little spring thing at East Nashville Beer Works again. So,
oh, okay.
A little plug for them, so that's right.
Are you playing there often now?
We play there New Year's Eve. They call it
Noon Year's Eve, yeah.
N-O-O-N, which is great. That's a big party.
Sure.
And then we're going to do play one time in the spring just for all the families and everything that go there. They have pizza, and parents can have a beer, and kids can drink their sodas and whatever. But that's you know, that's where I hang out, so it's kind of fun to play at a place where I know the staff and they like what I do because I played there a couple times.
Sure.
So we always have a good party there. So
is Family Wash closed now?
It's an Asian cuisine restaurant now.
So yes.
So
so it's not the Family Wash anymore.
I don't know if they've changed the name of it yet, but I've heard that's what they're going to do.
It's not the same ownership, is it?
No.
Oh, different. Okay.
Yeah, it's different.
Is there anybody around town that's doing a family kind of thing?
We're playing at Cheekwood. I got a bunch of shows coming up at Cheekwood, which is really great because it's beautiful over there.
So where's that?
The Botanical Gardens. It's over off of Harding Road. It's like it's in like Bellmead or something over there, but it's beautiful, you know, gardens, obviously, because it's called Botanical Gardens.
Right.
But, yeah. So it's just a nice, and they have sculptures there sometimes and they're awesome, but. So,
interesting.
It's fun.
Are you?
If you've been there, you should go there.
Are you working on? You're working on another record right now.
Yep, we're mixing.
Is this
it up.
The one that I played some stuff on?
Yes, you did.
Oh,
yes,
okay.
You did. And but one of the songs didn't make it that you guys played.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah, well, that's fine.
I was like, I said, man, there's too many songs in the key of G. I said, I can't throw another one on there. But I work with Marv Tritel over at his studio, and this is probably our fourth album we've worked on together. So. We're like the honeymooners. We're over there. It's like, why are you putting that on there? Why are you doing that? Back and forth. So we always fake that we're going to arm wrestle because we, you know, there's too much reverb on there. He's like, no, it's just enough. And I'm like, no, it's too much. So yeah, we're like an old married couple in the studio. So it's fun.
And he's
you know, he's fantastic at getting all the little bells and whistles together. And
yeah.
The spacing of the instruments and all the stuff that I don't really care about. I'm like, turn up the bass. So, it's like a domino. This is where we joke. It's the domino effect. You turn one thing up, everything else has to change.
Pretty much.
Tom Hurst was on drums and Ethan Pilzer's on bass on most of the songs. And
Chris Nix did a little guitar playing on some stuff too.
Yep, he did some awesome guitar work on there. And Johnny Duke played a solo on one of the things.
All the really boys. Cool.
Michael J. played a really cool solo on one of those songs. So, that's good. That's another cool thing about Nashville. I mean, there's so many great people and great musicians. And,
sure.
You know, I always joke with people and I said, I have like 4 tuba players in my phone. So
right.
It's like, I got guys I can call no matter what I do.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, there's so many people that are talented and they, you know, lend their talents to whatever project you're working on. It's great. like I said, it's a music community, you know.
So right. Yeah.
Everybody
yeah.
knows. Hey, you're doing a song in the studio. I'll come by and play. And you know, there's a
yeah.
You know, and people are not you know. Not asking for scale on this.
Well,
kind
no,
of
everybody's
of, you know,
everybody's kind of hustling and looking yeah. to make an extra buck here and there. Yeah. So, yeah, if they got the time and they whatever, I mean, and that's an amazing thing is you can call you know you can get world class people to play on stuff, uh-huh. and you
there's
know,
I was joking with somebody the other night that said like you know a guy I knew who ran a studio who says well you can get Dan Huff to come and play guitar on your song you just got to pay him.
No right.
I was like that's,
no, right.
that's so bizarre. Yeah. You wouldn't think of that in Rochester or someplace. You'd be like wait a minute like one of the best studio players in America
sure.
would come to play on my demo. It's like yeah you just have to pay him.
You pay him right. Yeah yeah they'll show up. Money talks.
Yeah exactly.
Yeah, right.
But it's like if you're here yeah it makes sense but like you know if you lived in Oklahoma somewhere you'd be like wait a minute.
Yeah it's right.
Like, wait who's playing on this record?
Yeah, right.
So I think we take it for granted here in Nashville because there's so many talented people here.
Sure.
And if somebody can't, you know, well, I'm double booked that day. Well, okay, well, I'll call this guy and he'll come in and play his
yeah.
tail off. And it'll be like, okay.
Yeah, right.
It works. Whatever works.
Yeah, right.
So it's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I do this, and this is going to be weird on this one, but I do this thing called Stories from the Road. That
you've
heard.
Dude, I got two of them for
oh,
you.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
Rock on, man. Okay, so.
First one is my rock band, we played in Last Horizon in Syracuse.
Lost Horizon. Yes. Played there.
Punk rock club, mosh pit in the front.
Huge mosh pit, like very, the so stage
Bill,
is like.
So Bill gets booked yep. there.
Yeah.
Bill, my friend Bill Holmes was my manager.
Oh, I thought you were just referring to yourself in the third person.
No, Bill Holmes. Other people have named Bill. He booked us at this thing. And I remember we had to get a substitute drummer. So we had a girl drummer and a girl bass player. Myself, my lead guitar player. I don't know if we had a girl singer with us or not. But we are about the most mainstream rock band you could probably
yeah.
think of.
Sure.
My music should not be in a punk rock club.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're walking in to the backstage door and there's a guy there with a mohawk, about 2 feet of mohawk, which at the time, this was the 80s, which was, they
oh,
were
yeah.
just coming on. And I'm thinking oh, like, yeah. hey, mosh pit, mohawk. We're walking in and my guitar player is behind me. And what does he say to the guy? Hey, nice hair.
Oh, God.
I was like, oh, my God, we're going to die because they're going to kill us. I mean, why would you say something
yeah.
like that?
Yeah, yeah.
It was just something I always remembered. And, oh, it was hilarious. But my Stories from the Road is, this is what it's like being a children's music performer. So we got called to do to play music at the Kidney Walk,
uh-huh.
which is at Centennial Park.
Right.
Great opportunity. Wonderful to get called. I'm excited about it.
Sure.
So we get there. There's a DJ set up with his DJ booth playing loud rock, playing what loud music of the day, whatever. And there's probably 250 to 300 people there. So I'm setting up. I go, this is going to be great. We're going to be playing to all these people. It's going to be fantastic.
Yeah.
So we're getting the last microphone set up and everything. And they say, okay, well, we're going to start the walk now. And everyone left. They all went on the walk. So here we are playing to like people that have like the booth, the lemonade guy. We played to like 14 people. And like in like the span of like 3 minutes, everyone left to go on the walk. And I'm like, this is not the way I thought this was going to go. So that was my Stories from the Road.
That's amazing. That's amazing. The only experience I have like that was we were doing a gig with Chuck Wicks, and Chuck is, for people listening, Chuck is like Mr. GQ looking, really good looking guy.
Good looking guy.
We played at a women's college in outside of Atlanta.
Good gig.
And at the end of the show, we would always play Chuck off. So he would say, like, I'll be over here at the booth signing, you know, merch or whatever. And we would, well, it wasn't that, but we would, you know, we would, often the band would be playing, like, you know, at the beginning of the show,
that's a cool thing.
You play the artist on as they come on.
That's a great move.
You play the artist off.
Great move.
So we're playing to a field full of like 95% women that are all drooling over Chuck. And we, this makes me laugh every time. So he's, you know, he's saying, all right, I'll be over at the merch booth, like right over there. If you want to, you know, take a picture, sign an autograph and all that kind of thing. And I'll see you later. Thanks for coming. So Chuck is like not even off the stage. And we watch a field full of like 1,000 women sprint off the field,
yeah,
like literally just like the parting of the Red Sea, and suddenly we're playing to an empty field, and he's, you know, he's over there doing his thing, and it was like the funniest thing because we had kind of a long playoff,
right?
And so we're standing there then playing to next to, like, there's like two dudes left in the field, and I'm like, well, that's how you know, that's, yeah, how you know you're a sideman for a country
power. Well, you know what you should do? You should have a kissing booth, like. Just charge, the side, like a dollar for a kiss,
and
give it to
kiss,
give it to charity or something like that.
Or give it,
give it to the band. It's like, thanks. Yeah, I don't know. It's dirty money. I don't know if I want it.
No, dirty money.
No, let me wash my hands first.
Yeah. Well, man, this has been fun. This is cool, like, man. It's, again, it's a trip being in, been in this room. And I want to thank you, I guess, publicly for, you know, giving me a place to stay, dude, and all that kind of thing for, you know, because I wouldn't have been able to do it without you. Yeah, and you got helped me get my first job here. Really?
True.
You gave me a recommendation for the folks at Innovative Percussion.
Yes.
And it actually led to, I live with one of the guys now who works at Innovative as the, you know, Henry Goh works as the, you know, the artist relations guy there. So you've helped me considerably, and you've been a great friend.
You're my brother,
and,
man. You're my
and
brother, man.
I appreciate it, man.
No
so
worries. No
we'll,
worries.
Play, and you got to tell me, I want to play one of your songs at the end here, but you got to tell me which one you want me to play.
I'll send you an
We'll figure that out. So thanks, man. Appreciate it. Thanks, buddy.
It's fun.
Awesome. Cool. Right on, man. That's it.
That was it.
That's it.
Podcast.
Yeah. Okay, I hope you all enjoyed my talk with my friend Bill. Always a fun time hanging out with that guy. Take a visit to Bill's website, BillCrosbyMusic.com. That is BillCrosby Music.com. He's also got a bunch of videos up on YouTube. Just do a search and you'll find him there. If you live in the Nashville area or anywhere else Bill is going to be playing and you have children, bring them out to one of his shows. I guarantee they'll love it. Do me a favor and give me a follow on the socials as well. I am at Michael J. Music on Facebook and Twitter, and at Michael J. Official on Instagram. We also have a PayPal donation button on our website, tiopod.com. Throw us a few dollars if you're so inclined, so we can keep bringing you this show for free. You don't have to donate, but I'll love you forever if you do. And we are inching our way toward 50 episodes. I'm planning something for fun once we get there, so come back for that. And if you like the show, tell your friends about it, and tell me about it too. Drop me a line at mj@tiopod.com. That is letter M, letter J, at tiopod.com. Send me your own stories from the road also, and I'll read them out. I don't care what they're about or who they're about. Do it. And that's it. Another show's coming your way next week, and I'm going to leave you here with a song from Bill Crosby's forthcoming record, Gather the Kids Around. This is called Bears Love Cupcakes, and I will see you all again next time here on Turn It On.
There was a bear in my kitchen. Wasn't growling or hurt. He had his paws around something I was saving for dessert. There were crumbs on the floor. I saw frosting on his fur. As I hid behind the door, this I did concur. Bears love cupcakes. Bears love cupcakes. If you're near a forest or lake, be careful what you bake. Bears love cupcakes. Now was he watching the cubs play after climbing on my roof? Or did he stick his snout through the skylight and then come crashing through? I know the sweet things are hard to resist, but I wasn't expecting a situation like this. Bears love cupcakes. Bears love cupcakes. After this home intrusion, I can jump to this conclusion. Bears love cupcakes. Thank you. front door open. When he left, he lumbered under me. I had a bird's eye view after climbing up my tallest tree. Bears love cupcakes. Bears love cupcakes. If you're near a forest or lake, be careful what you bake. Bears love cupcakes.